The Farm in the Countryside podcast is brought to you by Nutrien Ag Solutions, the world's largest provider of crop inputs and services, delivering unparalleled grower access to high-performance inputs, innovative technologies, and personalized agronomic expertise. Welcome to this edition of Farming the Countryside. This week, we've been at the Farm Progress Show in Boone, Iowa. The first day of the show was somewhat eventful. In fact, the interview you're about to hear was concluded just ahead of a severe thunderstorm that forced the evacuation of the expo grounds. Fortunately, all turned out fine, but I wanted to share with you this interview with Chuck Magro. Chuck is CEO of Nutrien. We simply began by talking about a company that is new, yet old, all wrapped into one. Chuck was visiting with producers at the Farm of the Future at Nutrien's booth at Farm Progress this week, and I enjoyed the chance to catch up with him and talk about the company. Well, coming up, we visit with someone who knows the ledger side of farming very well. It's next on Farming the Countryside. Nutrien is a name that many people are familiar with, but yet it's a new name. So for those that aren't familiar, take me back to Nutrien and how we got to this point right now.
Yeah, well, Nutrien is the, it's only literally 8 months old. January 1st is when we went live with the name, and it's the culmination of 2 years of work between Agrium and Potash Corp being the merger. And I'll tell you, the hardest part of the merger was actually naming the company. we had 5,500 employee submissions. So that's how we named the. We came up with the name Nutrien. It was actually two employees out of our 20,000 employees picked the name Nutrien. And it was a contest. It was a lot of fun. And the winners got to ring the New York Stock Exchange bell, which was a pretty exciting event for all of us, especially for them. And so we came up with the name Nutrien, and it's I think it's going really well right now.
Talk about that name, and maybe when they submitted it, did they have to give any rationale of why that name was important to them? What's behind the name then, in a sense?
Yeah, so, you know, I don't know if I'll do them justice, but it has to do with being, a nutrient provider, for sure. And we wanted to stay close to our historical roots of really connecting and servicing our grower customers and our other retail customers around the world. And Nutrien just seemed to fit what we're trying to create with the new company.
As I look at this kind of from an outsider, if you will, change can be difficult and a name change can be difficult, but yet it seems like people have been welcoming, you know, put the signage and everything. People have really gravitated to that. Why do you think that has gone, in my perspective, so well?
Yeah, it has gone really well, and I'm pleasantly surprised. If you look at the history of the Nutrien, the company now, you know, we're a product of really decades of mergers and acquisitions. So we had various different names and brands that we're very proud of all of them around the world. But this was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to pull the company together to represent our customers under one brand globally. And I think what got people excited was that opportunity to be part of something bigger than we were and focused on our grower customers, which is really, really important. And I'm really delighted just how people have taken to the new name and the rebranding. It's been phenomenal to see. And the company is completely focused on making sure we're delivering value for our customers, and I think our employees just rally around that.
I was going to ask that, how do you, when you have a large company that deals in many countries, but you have farmers on the land, how do you continue to bring something that's large down to their scale, which is something that has to be very local to have benefit for them?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, the simple answer is it starts actually from the grower. So we don't do anything without speaking and working for our growers. And then the rest of it is all geared, the machine, if I will, because it is a big company now. It's 20,000 employees in 14 countries, and we provide everything from nutrients, seed, chemistry, but we also provide all the service, and now we provide agronomic knowledge, of course, and ag technology. But we don't do any of that unless the growers want it and need it and we can create value for them. And I think that's what really sets us apart, is that we want our 20,000 employees to get up every day and say, how can they help feed the world and how can they help our farmers grow more food more sustainably?
With the change, any other changes that are coming just besides the name, or is it in a sense business as usual just with a new name?
Well, inside of the company right now, there is a what I would call a strategic shift. So everybody knows that Nutrien is integrated. We go right from production through distribution to the farm. But what we're trying to do now is we're trying to change our product offering, so not just providing fertilizer or seed or chemistry. And we've always done that. We've always provided service to farmers. But now we really want to make sure that we are, for example, their technology provider of choice. We want to make sure that they have all the data that they need and the analytics they need to make good business decisions. So inside of the company, we're hoping that we're going to grow beyond just products and services to more of a solutions provider and make sure that we're working shoulder to shoulder with farmers around the world to help them increase their profit, but more than that, grow food in a sustainable manner. Because really, if you look at what's happening around the world, we've got less water, less arable land, and there's just finite resources on the planet, and we have to make sure that we're working and using technology to feed a growing population.
Well, I don't know, wind up with this. You have a lot of responsibility, obviously, with your role, but I would think events like this are special because you do get to meet so many growers out here and you're talking to the end customer.
This is one of my favorite days of the year, is to be here at the Farm Progress Show. I do get to interact with our customers and as importantly, our employees. I don't get to do this often enough. I'm usually in a boardroom somewhere. So this is a real treat for me, and I can't tell you how important it is to stay focused on our customers, and I can tell you right from the top down, that's what we're planning to do.
And Nutrien Ag Solutions, a new day is upon us. The rebrand from Crop Production Services marks a defining moment in a storied history. Driven by renewed promise and purpose, today Nutrien Ag Solutions is more equipped to grow our world from the ground up and serve the agricultural community than ever before. Delivering the same valued personalized service that shaped countless trusted relationships with access to a new unrivaled network of business capabilities that will carry them into tomorrow. In an industry ever influenced by change and uncertainty, their continued commitment to every grower's journey will deliver new possibilities. We are partners, advocates, advisors, and stewards of success. We are Nutrien Ag Solutions. Rex Broad is the market manager for U.S. Bank in Maryville, Missouri. Rex, as you will hear, has been in the ag lending business for many years. We started out just by talking about the changes he's seen from those turbulent years in the farm crisis up to today, where he's helping farmers with the challenge of making a living from the land. It's much more than just a conversation about finances. It's really a conversation about life on the farm. And I think you'll enjoy the ground we covered. Well, this time on Farming the Countryside, my guest is Rex Broad. And I've known Rex for several years. But Rex, you work with U.S. Bank. Take me back to when you began, because you have been around farming and ag lending for a number of years.
Yes, Andrew, I have. I started back in 1982. I was hired as a management trainee through the bank. And in January of 1983 is when I first started in agricultural lending. And some of you can recall, some of your listeners and your audience probably can remember back in the 80s in the farm crisis. And that's when I really got my education with agriculture and agricultural lending. There's a lot of things they don't teach you in college about bankruptcy and foreclosure and just dealing with difficult situations, both from a psychological aspect and a financial aspect, in liquidation of farms and devaluation of property and dealing with collection of debt and how people react. Both, you know, people back then, people normally do the right thing, and they're ethical and moral, and then they make good decisions. But when they're put in a desperate situation, their animal characteristics come out. So we dealt with some of that. We also, you know, the big education back then, too, was bankruptcy laws. We were just learning what the bankruptcy laws included, how they worked, how the court system dealt with a lot of those situations.
When you started, had things gotten really bad yet, or was it another 2 or 3 years before things were in dire straits here?
It was just the beginning. Some of your listeners will probably remember back in the early 80s and the mid 80s when interest rates, when the federal Fed rate, Fed funds rate, and the prime rate got up in the low 20% range. And some of your listeners obviously won't have lived through in that time frame. But those of us that have know that it's a very difficult time to generate enough profit in a farming operation. But in addition, if you've got much debt or leverage at all, that to generate that additional 20% interest on that operating capital that you borrowed.
I'm interested. Did it affect you to the point that you thought, I don't want to do this? Because that had to be hard discussions sometimes with a lot of people.
Absolutely. It was a difficult time. There was, you know, we used to joke about this a little bit. I guess laugh versus cry, but oftentimes back in the mid-80s when things were really at their worst point, we always made sure we had Kleenexes in our office, plenty of cigarette ashtrays because a lot of our borrowers were heavy smokers at that point in time, and just to make sure that, you know, people were as comfortable as possible to talk about the situation. The best thing that anyone can do when they're in a problem situation is just be honest, you know, and straightforward with the situation, circumstances, and work together to resolve it. But again, oftentimes when people were pressed in those kind of situations, they reverted where they were quiet. They didn't either come see us at all, or they were hiding grain or selling livestock, you know, out of trust. And that's when the laws changed too. When regulation was changed so that the security interest in grain and livestock, the buyers of those products had to make the checks out jointly in order to make sure those proceeds went where they should go.
How did that time period influence how you look at things today with ag lending? I would think that not only do you have experience, but you had experience seeing some things that younger lenders, they hear about, but they didn't live through it.
No, and even the most experienced lenders at that time were having a difficult time dealing with the situation. We were all learning as the regulations changed and as people were pressed in hard situations, how they dealt with it. I can remember some weekends moving machinery back then. Now, today you would probably never do that, but we were at that time when I worked for the bank was just a small bank holding company, and I've changed tires, I've replaced radiators and combines, just working on things, getting machinery that had been abandoned by a farmer that couldn't deal with the situation and didn't want to deal with us, abandoned the collateral. And of course, we as lenders were there then to go to the farm and gather the machinery, get it in running order, and then get it so that it was ready for an auction or a sale at that time.
As we think about today, some things have changed, but some things remain the same. Would you say interest has been one thing that has changed a lot? Is that the biggest thing that has changed? Because we still have financial stress, but we don't see it the same. How do you compare it to today?
I think by and large, I mean, if you look at specifically just interest has changed dramatically. You know, even in today's environment where we're seeing the Fed, you know, have raised interest rates over the last 2 years, marginally 1.5% to 2%, this is still insignificant. When I started back in the 80s, you know, you got to a point where you felt like a fair lending rate or a rate that would both return to the depositor that made the deposits for the money and also for the borrower that borrowed the money, 7, 8, 9% was reasonable. You know, we've been fortunate. We're coming out of a period of time now when operating funds in 4 to 5% aren't uncommon. Now we're getting closer. It's creeping back up. We've got several borrowers that are in the 5 to 6% range. But that's changed drastically.
When you look at agriculture today, certainly the farms have gotten larger. Has the leverage changed from the 80s a lot?
Absolutely. You know, the double-edged sword that happened back in the 80s was that we were coming off of an inflationary period of time when you bought a piece of machinery in the late 70s, early 80s, it retained that value, but it probably increased in value, so it was always worth more. And the same was true for land at that point in time. Land was always going to go up. It was never going to go down. We were told, you know, there just wouldn't be any decline in price. Well, what happened was when our production failed and our higher interest rates, we also saw our asset valuation drop. And it didn't just drop 10, 20, 30%. It dropped as much as 60% in some land values and machinery values. And that's where it really, it made it very precarious for us as a lender because all of a sudden our collateral that was worth one value, you know, 3 years ago, today it's worth 40% as much. So and regulators were pushing us, our examiners were pushing us because of the drop in the collateral valuation, you know, that we were undersecured, prices were failing, higher interest rates, and the longer it continued, the worse it got for everyone.
When you work with clients today, with farmers, do you see a big difference between those that lived through the 80s and farmed through it, through younger producers that didn't, and how they just simply deal with finances and how they look at their operation?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Those folks that survived, that generation that survived the 80s and that crisis, whether they were somewhat leveraged or not, and they sustained their operation and made it through, today they're much better managers as far as looking at risk, at leverage. Most of our borrowers today are to a point where they've got 50% equity at least in their operation. They're, they, you know, we were trained as lenders to look much stronger at cash flow. And absolutely, we have to be cash flow lenders, where the only way you're going to service your debt is through earnings and profit, not just asset appreciation.
So what are the things that younger producers need to look at more that they don't think about that maybe the older ones do? And I'm sure that is hard to – you can't stereotype everybody because young producers can be different. But are there things that younger generation needs to look at differently?
I think our younger generation, because they don't have that experience, they didn't live through a time basically when interest rates, you know, were double digit, if, you know, 20%. They also, you know, a lot of our younger producers over the last 10 years, you know, you could really do no wrong in farming. We've had been very blessed with crop production yields. We've had, you know, average to above average rainfall historically, some tremendous prices on our commodities. You know, our energy prices have been, well, they've been higher, but they've been all in perspective. It's been good. And really farming for the most part has been very, very profitable for most managers over the last decade.
Talk about land prices and rent prices for a moment. You know, back in the 80s, it was interest that was so high, and that was a difficult thing. It seems like, and maybe things have stabilized a little bit, is that, in a sense, our rent prices of today? Is that what eats up a lot of our cash flow, being able to try to decide, okay, am I going to go out and spend the cash rent, or I'm going to go out and purchase the land? Because some of the land prices, we say it's high, but that's all relative depending where you live. But what do you see out there?
You know, it's interesting you ask about that, because we've seen cash rents, you know, here a few years ago when we had $6 and $7 corn and $15 beans, you know, we saw some of our cash rents go up close to $300 in some case scenarios on river bottom. As an average, you know, that's dropped from that. I think still on the bottoms in this part of the country are the high producing ground, you're still looking in the $200 range. Is that an overhead that's comparable with higher interest rates back in the 80s? You know, it's definitely an overhead, and it has enhanced and increased. I think each one of our producers are looking at where they can justify their cost. You know, what kind of production history is that ground? What kind of soil capacity does it have? The fertility, all those things. And our leases have gotten much more complicated than they were back in the 80s. You know, a basic lease back in the 80s really didn't get into the fertility levels. And the control as far as erosion control and those kind of things. And a lot of our leases today are based upon maintaining, sustaining the value of the land and the fertility of the land. So it continues to be profitable for the next generation.
Do you think for a lot of producers today that are wanting either to rent or buy, is there more competition from outside investors than there used to be, as far as somebody who wants to come in and buy the neighboring piece, not because they're going to farm it, but because they're going to turn around and rent it?
You know, that's a good point. You know, now that our markets, our stock markets and mutual fund markets and so forth are coming back and generating higher returns, you know, at one time with interest rates where they were soft 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, many investors were looking at alternative investment options, and real estate, farm real estate, was a fairly attractive investment. I mean, it had sustained its value over the long term as far as capital gains. The return was in the neighborhood of 3 to 5%. You were pretty well protected as far as risk go, because you were cash renting the ground, But to answer your question on who is buying a lot of this farmland, well, there's investors out there, and they have been purchasing a lot of our land. I'd say 60% or more of our land is being bought by neighboring farmers. You know, people in the community that have well established their farming operations, they've got their debt pretty well retired, and they're looking at expanding their operation. They know farming. They don't know about the stock market or those companies that sell stocks, but they do know about farmland, and they're comfortable with it, and that's where they've expanded their capital.
I know this would be hard to answer because one size doesn't fit all, but how do you go out and advise? It could be a young farmer, an older farmer, when a piece of ground comes up somewhat nearby for rent or for sale, you may only get one shot at it in a lifetime. So do you have to, in some cases, suspend the way you look at things financially, knowing that? Or how do you come to grips with that, because that it can be a once-in-a-generation type of decision?
You're absolutely right. You know, for many farms, you know, that was a common comment that was made when I was growing up on the farm, that farmland's only going to be available one time, and if we don't get it bought, you know, we won't have an opportunity again in our lifetime. You know, what I try to do with borrowers when they come in, they're looking at purchasing land, we obviously look at the economics of it. You know, what will the land produce in relationship to what the costs are? Obviously, most of the land, if not all of the land that's being bought today, you know, it's not at a point where it will generate enough income to service its own debt. So then we have to look at the overall financial picture. You know, where is this individual at in their operation? How important is it to them and to their operation to expand that? How important is it to use that capital and without depleting your operating capital, but to spend some money that you've set aside maybe for other capital replacement, whether it would be machinery or livestock and so forth, and put it into a land investment? And that's where the individual borrower has to look at too and see how it impacts their operation financially. You know, we do projections all the time to see once where they can go as far as how high they can bid on land. A lot of our land in this part of the country is being sold by auction. And it seems like that's generating a tremendous value today and tremendously high prices. And it's very competitive. You know, years ago, it used to be more private treaty. Neighbors sold to neighbors or to other family members in order to keep it in the family or keep it in the community. Today, because you've got so many absentee landowners or the heirs live away from the farming operation, they're just interested in maximizing their return. So that's why they're going to public auction.
Is that been good, bad, or does it matter going auction versus private treaty, do you think?
You know, there's pros and cons to every situation. If you're looking at maximizing the return of the owners, the heirs now, you know, that's probably the best way that they can get the highest return is to sell it at auction. If you're looking at it from longevity of neighboring farmers or the younger farmers that are trying to get established, you know, I was at an auction not too many weeks ago that it sold and a retired farmer that had money in the bank ended up buying the land, but bought it for probably $3,000 more an acre than a young farmer that was renting the ground right now could afford to pay. So you're eliminating some of the younger farmers' ability to purchase this land by selling it at auction or selling it to outsiders.
How do you think that affects younger farmers then? Are they having to be more aggressive and go out and pay rents? Because you see a lot of people that go out and pay rents and try to expand that way. Has it changed how a young farmer has to do business these days?
You know, it has a little bit in that if the farmer that bought this particular farm, he's interested in renting it back. And I know he's going to charge more rent than the younger farmer that was interested in purchasing it is paying now for that same farm. So it's going to increase that younger farmer's overhead. You know, given just the valuation of land right now and how it's continued to increase and the investor, whoever owns it, if they're not really interested in helping the young farmer sustain himself, they're going to be looking at maximizing their return. So the younger farmers' costs are going to continue to go up. As they try to expand their operation, they're going to be limited by that upside potential of outside interest in purchasing land at higher prices, and also those investors that purchase that higher price land on what their return that they're going to anticipate and expect out of it.
How do you advise then young people that are wanting to not only keep the business going but try to expand? Is there has that changed as far as that advice from the 80s and when you started?
You know, I guess the main thing I'd want to tell anyone that gets involved in any business, and farming is a business. You know, that's what well, those of us that were raised on the farm and we're passionate about farming and it does become a way of life, it's still a business and it still needs to be operated as such. So I guess the key thing for longevity of whoever's in production agriculture is you got to make sure that it's going to work for you, that it's going to pay its way, that whatever leverage or whatever capital purchase you're looking at, is it going to work for your operation so that you can afford it, you can still have and face any adversity with some cushion and maintain and sustain some operating capital.
I want to jump over to the opposite end of the spectrum for a moment because we've had this discussion before as well. Older farmers that are maybe are going to phase out rent land or so forth, that value of that land is pretty significant. It's certainly gone up. What are some of those farmers doing that maybe they have heirs, but maybe there's nobody coming along that's going to farm it afterwards? Are they choosing mostly to pass it on to the heirs and in a sense that money leaves that community forever? What are you seeing from landowners now that have, in a sense, they have a lot of value in that land and they've got to do something with that value?
You know, that's a good question. You know, and I've been in banking over 30 years, and I guess during that time I've seen some retired farmers where maybe their children, the heirs, weren't interested in farming, and they would approach me and say, you know, we're going to have to sell the farm as we get older because, well, that was our retirement vehicle so we could go buy a house in town, or maybe we just need to sell it and liquidate it because the children don't want to, we don't want to burden them with dealing with the hassle of the farm. What I've tried to encourage people today is that, you know, your family and for generations, maybe you've established that farming operation. Maybe it's been passed down from generation to generation. And even though you don't have any heirs that are interested in farming that operation, they can still sustain that ownership through a trust or some type of vehicle where they can sustain that asset that's been established by the family, and also it can continue to make an earning for the family members. Even though they're not involved with the day-to-day operations, they can still reap the benefit of that farming operation and those ancestors, all that work.
Are you having to have a lot more conversations then with people that own land that really aren't involved with the land?
A little bit more, yes, absolutely. And getting them comfortable with the farm managers that exist today, farming practices. You know, as the USDA changes the farm plans, the farm programs, you know, we've had to have a lot more expertise, not only from the fertility, but the USDA government programs and federal government programs. You know, what's going on in farming and how it's impacted land ownership and the usage of it. So it's important to bring those individuals that are professionals, like professional farm managers, to operate those farms and consistently generate that return back to the heirs.
You have dealt with a lot of different customers, and I'll make this a little more personal for just a second. My father is still the guy that, while very sharp, does everything by, you know, pencil and paper. It reminds me of the 1930s when they kept ledger books at banks, you know, and they shut down at 2 o'clock to figure the books. Are those guys still handling things well as far, you know, my dad doesn't use a computer and so forth, but I'm sure you have a lot of those type of customers still. But they live through some of those difficult times. Are they better managers than the young guys a lot of times?
You know, in some aspects, I would say because of their experience and their world of their wealth of knowledge that they have in dealing with practical situations and adversity, you know, people like your dad have dealt with a lot of adversity through their lives. And they know if they've survived that economically, they know to put everything to a pencil. You know yourself, when you guys make a purchase, you know, your dad and you sit down and you sit down, does this make sense for our farming operation? You know, and I think that's something that a lot of our younger people don't necessarily do. They get excited about the thrill of the acquisition or the purchase and so forth, but maybe sometimes don't take the time that they need to analyze the full economic impact of the operation.
Well, and some people may not know about this, and I think you know this, but when I was a kid, we left Burger King because it was too expensive. I remember that, you know. So those things make an impact on you. I'm interested, and I know this would be difficult to put into one sentence or one piece of advice, but for the younger folks coming along, what are one of the two key things that they need to keep in mind as they're going forward? I know it depends a lot on the operation size, but you've been through a lot and been through a lot of family meetings and around a lot of farms. What are those couple of things that they need to be thinking about more?
You know, one of the things that I think this is any individual, but especially in farming, if you have a love for agriculture, is keep an open mind. I mean, talk to those professionals. Don't make quick, hasty decisions. Farming operations today are more... I guess they're more diversified, but there's also so much information out there from a technology standpoint, fertility, farm management, the programs that are out there. Gather as much information as you can to make the best decisions you can for you and your operation. That's one piece of advice. I think the other piece of advice is just continue to look at your operation from an economic standpoint. You know, what makes sense? What am I going to benefit? How am I going to benefit the decisions that I make today that I can keep the longevity in this operation and sustain it while still being profitable and as efficient as possible?
Why don't I wind up with this? You cover clients Northwest Missouri, but into Iowa, Nebraska, Kansas. What are you seeing just as far as crops this year? In general, the U.S. has seen a pretty good crop, but what are you seeing here?
You know, we're in a tough situation this year, Andrew. It's one of those situations where, you know, the surrounding areas around us are really a breadbasket. You know, with the crop report I heard this morning that 72 to 73% of our corn crop in the United States right now is in good to excellent condition. Well, we've been, unfortunately, in a situation here in this part of the country, in Northwest Missouri and Northeast Kansas, that we have suffered from a drought. And there's been awful spotty showers all spring. We didn't come out of the winter season with good subsoil moisture. So it's really, and the heat of the May-June temperatures have really put us in a precarious situation. You know, we're anxious to see now. The 30-day forecast is, I think, below average temperature temperatures and above average moisture, which will help our soybean crop better. I think our corn crop is pretty well established right now. So the unfortunate part about this part of the country this year right now is that we've seen continued depressed grain prices because of the abundance around us, and yet we're not going to have a crop. Probably we'll be lucky to have an average crop this year.
That means you've got even a tougher job to do.
Absolutely. It'll be a challenge this fall. But, you know, the main thing is that I would encourage anyone, wherever you're at, you know, visit with your lender, feel comfortable with that lender, and talk one-on-one, because the best decisions you can come to are those you make together.
That's Rex Broaden with U.S. Bank out of Maryville, Missouri, on this edition of Farming the Countryside.
The Farm in the Countryside podcast has been brought to you by Nutrien Ag Solutions, the world's largest provider of crop inputs and services, delivering unparalleled grower access to high-performance inputs, innovative technologies, and personalized agronomic expertise.